Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Ray Armantrout, who has a new book called Versed from Wesleyan University Press. She is a poet. Her previous book of poetry was Next Lives, and there is also a new and selected poems that was published by Wesleyan called Vale. But the author of many books of poetry, whose work really, well, just in the last month and a half, I've seen poems in The New Yorker, The Nation, a reprint in Harper's Magazine. It seems like the world is changing, and poetry that once was regarded as difficult or obscure is now being accepted, in part because rather remarkable people are becoming editors of magazines. I think Paul Muldoon at The New Yorker and Peter Gizzi at The Nation, poets who themselves can recognize a new kind of work and the need for new work. I was once called by a listener who then sent a letter from Alaska telling me that the poems she heard on this show are not like the poems she heard growing up, and without being critical or determining things in advance, she wanted to know what is modern poetry. And so I wrote back to her saying that, you know, I don't think you can give a broad definition, but if you look poem by poem, you can tell what the poet thinks modern poetry is. And if you look at a poem by Ray Armantrout, you can see that modern poetry is fragmented. It comes in sections. There are brief sections. Poems are rarely longer than two pages. And the principle seems to be one of ongoing juxtaposition rather than progress. Now, you've said that when you were young, you got an anthology, and what you liked were the poems that seemed as if they were about to disappear or were about to explode. And you mentioned in particular William Carlos Williams and Emily Dickinson. And I wondered if you could talk about poems that are about to disappear or explode.
Well, with Williams, you see that a poem can be made out of anything. At least that's what I found in Williams. His famous poem, This Is Just to Say, I have eaten the plums that you were probably saving for breakfast. And then I don't remember the next line, but it ends, they were delicious, so cold and so sweet. And you can see that basically that's an apology note that, you know, I don't think they had Post-its then, but that he, if they had had Post-its, he would have put that on the refrigerator for his wife so that, you know, she might not be too upset when she saw that the plums were gone. And it does work as a poem. I wish I had it here to read, but despite its simplicity, what it does is it makes you feel how delicious those plums are and how it might be worthwhile to live in the moment and not to postpone pleasure, you know, till breakfast. You better have it now, you know. So there's a kind of a philosophy behind that little note of apology. And all of that comes out in about 8 lines, very succinct. And that's what I saw when I first started reading, is that there could be poetry everywhere, really. And I thought that was exciting. And then in terms of poetry that might explode, and Emily Dickinson, she once defined poetry. She said, if I feel physically as if the top of my head had been taken off, I know that's poetry. So for her, she was drawn to the radical and the extreme. And sometimes, I mean, when I encountered her in my childhood, she was anthologized in kind of nature anthologies, and she was seen as a sort of sweet little poet of nature. But when you really look at those works, I mean, they are so strange. She puts two words together that you've never seen together before quite often. And she challenges the orthodoxies of her day, you know, the religious ideas, the ideas about immortality. I mean, she obsesses about them, but she also questions them in a way that was very radical. And since I grew up in a fundamentalist household, I really heard that questioning. And also, she has that tremendous succinctness, that compression, where big ideas are getting compressed into a knot. And I guess that's where I got the sense of something that might explode, is just that if material is under high pressure from being compressed, then it has an explosive potential.
Well, isn't it interesting because, you know, when Emily Dickinson was published, it wasn't just the Maid of Amherst stuff. It was published as demure poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And now we can hardly look at it without a feeling of terror.
Exactly.
It's really extraordinary that things have two faces. And it seems to me that in your poetry, much of the design is to see that things are double-faced, meanings are interpenetrating with one another, not separate from one another, and that the interest is in simultaneity.
I think that's very true. That's perfect. Yes. One effect that I like, because it creates a sense of the uncanny, and I guess I find a lot of the world somehow uncanny and disturbing, and I like to reflect that in my poetry. But one thing that can provoke a sense of the uncanny is when you think you understand something, you know, you think you're on familiar ground, and then all of a sudden you realize, whoops, there's a whole nother way to see this. What I was seeing, you know, might not be the truth. And then you switch to a totally other perspective. And it's not that the second one is more true than the first one. You just realize, oh, now how many levels are there? It's like kind of falling through a false bottom, perhaps. And like Alice in Wonderland, there might be false bottom after false bottom. I feel that way about reality, and so I sort of try to reproduce that effect in my work.
It seems to me that it would be interesting to start with one of your poems from the new book, Versed. In a way, Versed is a double book, and it's interesting to talk about this because this is a feature of life today. A publisher announced that they wouldn't be able to publish a second book until 3-4 years from now. And so essentially this book is two books put together.
Yes.
One called Verse and one called Dark Matter. And I thought of this poem, which is called Had. The poems are often one-word titles, often a word in the poem. I thought of it as a poem that disappears as it goes along, and that it had certain things that are revealing of the nature of your poems, in particular that the reader has to discover or not discover the context in which certain things are said. So this is Ray Armantrout reading Had from her book, Versed.
Had. And so I ask, do you need both skies? I say keep jets and its consistent. I suggest again that you strip down while remaining calm. It may be that reclining lessens the pressure or presence, But there are still sensations to be considered. No, not considered. Dealt with. No, not dealt with either. Had, perhaps, but with no rights of possession, no sense of constituting past.
Had by Ray Armantrout. Now, what I noticed suddenly the third or fourth time I read the poem, that the first section is a teacher speaking to a student about revising a poem. Let's hear the first part again so you can hear how exactly, once you place it, you see what it
mm-hmm.
is.
And you are exactly right about that. And so I ask, do you need both skies? I say, keep jets and its consistent. I suggest again that you strip down while remaining calm.
So there we already have the beginning of a transition. The while remaining calm, you know, strip down is an inevitable piece of Ray Armantrout advice. It has nothing to do with removing clothing. It has to do with removing excess words, excess baggage from a poem, getting at the essence. But suddenly, the words stripped down suggest another more menacing situation. The word jets suggests an airplane and remaining calm while you fasten your seatbelts in turbulence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we're watching the poem before our very eyes go through a crossfade into another material. So let's hear part two again.
Okay. It may be that reclining lessens the pressure or presence, but there are still sensations to be considered. No, not considered, dealt with. No, not dealt with either. Had, perhaps, but with no rights of possession, no sense of constituting past.
Now we're dropping through what you called those false bottoms, where no word is going to give us what wants or needs to be said, because there is nothing that wants or needs to be said. The poem is going into a kind of free fall. We now seem to be on an airplane, and we're talking about lessening the pressure. But there, it also seems to be someone who might be sick or have a bad back, and reclining might lessen the pressure. So there are still sensations to be considered, but the context from the first suddenly has put the poem in the mood of revising itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But this rewriting is kind of a metaphysical rewriting. So sensations are no longer being considered but dealt with, not dealt with but had. And then let's look at had, the tiniest mm-hmm. of all words, and it dissolves too. And not had in the sense of owning something. I had a house or a horse. And not had in the sense of a past tense. So that struck me as being an example of a poem that as it moves along disappears.
Yeah, I guess it dispossesses, to get back to the word had.
And it seems as if the poem is the record of watching something rather specific turn into the inability of language to address the situation directly or eventually through deconstruction at all.
Yeah, that's right. You're making me like this poem more than I did. It's not one that I generally read when I give readings, but now you're making me get more enthused about it.
Well, it was that word that you used, the disappearing poem, and as I looked at it, I became aware that this is a disappearing poem.
Mm-hmm.
And that the words themselves being considered get smaller and smaller, as if the very atoms of matter are what are disappearing or becoming, as they always are, invisible, and that this is a subject of many of the poems,
mm-hmm.
the growing invisibility of what needs to be said. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Ray Armantrout, author most recently of Versed, published by Wesleyan University Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Ray Armantrout about her new book of poetry, Versed. Now, it seems to me that while the poems are very particular, they do have a metaphysical view, or, how to put it, a view that's the result of what people call the death of metaphysics. That once the sense of the world being held together by an invisible order, that the breakdown of that order or the breakdown of our belief in that order is very much a part of these poems. And people tell me that you're always reading philosophy and theory. And I'm very interested because all these poems use very simple and accessible language. A reader might never know that you were reading Lacan.
Well, I have read some Lacan, but I don't know who your sources are. It's not that I'm always reading theory. Haven't read Lacan for a while, but yeah, yes. But what I actually read more, really, and with more interest, is science writing. And so I read Scientific American, and I read all the various popularizations of physics from Brian Greene to Lee Smolin. And I get ideas and also language from that kind of reading, too. Also, I was raised in a sort of fundamentalist household, and when I was a child, I read most of the Bible. So that's still in my mind. As well as, you know, fairy tales and mythology. So I'm interested in the way that all of those discourses, as they say in theory, try to frame truth in very different ways. And it seems to me that the contemporary physics is almost as fantastical as fairy tales or mythology. I'm not saying that it's not true. I'm not going to talk about, you know, truth or lack of truth, but just that it stretches the imagination and the names of subatomic particles are almost like the angels that might have danced on a pin in medieval theology. So I like to sort of put these realms together and just kind of see what kind of sparks fly off when you can combine the different discourses that have described our world. And some of those might be post-structuralist theory, as you were suggesting. Sometimes it might be 20th century science, and sometimes it might be my experience of religion. And I don't think those things are really so unrelated.
And there are times, I think particularly in this book, where some of the content has to do with your dealing with cancer,
mm-hmm.
Where a spokesperson for the poet announces that the part is sick of representing the whole. That sickness in some way has to do with that funny thing of allowing oneself to be divided into parts, that you are not sick, that the heart is sick or the liver is sick. And now the part is not representing the whole. The part is sick of representing the whole.
Yeah.
It's kind of, what I felt was, as reading, that the poems are committed to re-representing the strangeness of human experience. If an earlier poetry were about the miraculousness of being alive, this is about how, when viewed, the world separates into parts that immediately go to war with one another and with their ways of being spoken as well, of being written. Let's hear a final poem.
Okay. Well, actually, I had surgery 2.5 years ago. And, yeah, but the period of sickness drags on. I mean, I have not had a recurrence, so that's the good news. But, you know, it was the kind of cancer that they really did expect to recur. The prognosis was not very good. And now I'm starting to call myself, I guess, a cancer survivor just because it's been 2.5 years. But it was a scary kind of cancer. And so I have had to have tests and, you know, be scanned and screened all the time. And this was written at a time when there was a question. There had been something had shown up on the scan that was problematic, and then they were just going to have to do another scan in 2 months. And so I had to wait, which was very stressful. And my son, by the way, Aaron Korkigian, is a molecular biologist. So he had been – it starts out with him trying to talk to me about evolution and trying to get me not to anthropomorphize it. And not to talk about, you know, not to imagine that the system has any kind of will in itself. So that's kind of where it starts. Simple for Aaron Korkigian. Complex systems can arise from simple rules. It's not that we want to survive. It's that we've been drugged and made to act as if we do. While all the while, the sea breaks and rolls painlessly under. If we're not copying it, we're lonely. Is this the knowledge that demands to be passed down? Time is made from swatches of heaven and hell. If we're not killing it, we're hungry.
Wow. Simple by my guest, Ray Armantrout. Now, is poetry, because after all, eventually these things end up, your notebook observations, they're words on a page in a book, and part of the process of poetry is to take experience and make somehow permanent its evanescence. It's transitoriness. And these poems, especially in Dark Matter, seem to have an idea of the irony of being as transitional between life and death while leaving behind things that are thought, at least by our old system, to be the memorializers of our lives, that, you know, that Shakespeare's sonnets will outlast the dying beauty of the young man they're dedicated to. And that somehow, too, that these poems have a funny way of becoming a marker to the presence that saw fit to note them.
Actually, they do work that way. For me, just in a private sense, I can often read a poem that was written 10 years ago, and I can remember where I was sitting when I started writing it, what I was looking at, even if what I was looking at didn't make it into the poem. It reactivates the whole scene for me. At the same time, and I think this is what you were getting at, I sort of can't help but see this attempt to catch at the present and make it, I dread to say the word eternal, but make it eternal, I can't help but see that as essentially hopeless. I mean, if a poet is very lucky, like Shakespeare was very lucky, then, and very well, I don't want to say it was luck, but the best a poet can hope for is to be read for, you know, maybe 100, 200 years after his or her death. But that's not very long. And then at this point in time, in history, I'm not sure that our civilization has another 100 or 200 years. I mean, I think we all feel that. We all hope that that's not true, but I think we all feel that we have come to a point where things could go south very quickly for a number of reasons. And, you know, the idea that there are still going to be, you know, books and libraries and bookstores and readers is something we can't count on. And yet we go ahead. I mean, I know that for me, I often take what's disturbing. In fact, I usually write about what's disturbing to me. I usually start with, even if it's something that's beautiful, it's a kind of beauty that has startled me somehow, and being startled has a partly negative aspect. So I usually start with something that has disturbed me. And I turn that disturbance, I guess, into something that in the end I enjoy enough to keep. And I realize that that's ironic, but that's what I do. And, you know, whether I'm doing it just for myself or for other people, I can't say, but I know that I'm doing it for myself. I don't want to say that I'm taming the things that frighten me, because I hope that my poems are not tame, but I am somehow transforming them in some sense from raw, from a kind of raw intrusion into my sensibility to something that I have exerted control over.
That's wonderful. I understand. I've been talking with Ray Armantrout, author most recently of Versed, published by Wesleyan University Press. Thank you, Ray, for joining me.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.